This is Richly Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We're going to talk now with the co-author of a book, which is actually a continuation of two previous editions of the book, which is entitled Gary, A Pictorial History. We have with us IU Northwest History Professor Emeritus James Lane, who, along with his co-author Ron Cohen, have been working on this book. And the latest edition of the book is the third edition. Can you believe this? It's hard to believe that they've had three editions of the book so far.
Well, it's great because it first came out in 1982, and then 20 years later we had a chance to update it and add a chapter taking it up to date. And likewise, recently we had an opportunity, thanks to the Legacy Foundation and the City of Gary, our sponsors, to bring it right up to the year 2018.
For folks that are not familiar with this book, you can obviously check it out from the library. You can find it all around. You probably have extra copies at the Calumet Region Archives, don't you, and at the IU Northwest. But there may be people that would like to find copies of their own, have copies of their own. But for those who are not familiar with the book, give us an idea going from the very start of the book all the way to where we stand now in the 21st century.
Sure. Well, Gary was founded in 1906, but we have a chapter dealing with the sparsely settled area prior to that time and the coming of the railroads and the Etna gunpowder factory and Swedes moving to Miller and the Calumet Gun Club. Mm-hmm. And then really with U.S. Steel founding the city and buying up 7 or so miles of shoreline. We have pictures of the construction of the mill, but we tried to emphasize people in our pictorial history, the diversity of Gary, all the scores of ethnic groups that settled here from Central and Southern and Eastern Europe, and a lot of coal miners from Pennsylvania coming out here to work in the mills. And even going up to our final chapter, the 16 pages that are in color, we tried to basically argue against the stereotype that Gary's, you know, a virtual ghost town. So many people like to explore the so-called ruins of Gary, City Methodist and Union Station. That we wanted to show the variety of activities that the people of Gary are still involved with. You know, so we have photos of church services and school activities, people protesting the efforts by GEO to build an immigration detention center near the Gary Airport. Mm-hmm. The air show at Marquette Park, the people gathering every year at Michael Jackson's boyhood home, and that kind of stuff.
Now, how did the book actually get started, how the first edition came to be?
Well, the Donning Company specializes on, you might say, tabletop pictorial histories. There's one that the historian Lance Trusty did of Hammond. Archibald McKinley did one of East Chicago. And so we had the opportunity, if we could raise enough money to have it in print. And in those days, the Gary National Bank and the Post Tribune were our sponsors. And this last one, like I say, the Legacy Foundation, which has sponsored many local projects, and the City of Gary were our two main sponsors. So in other words, Donnie got their money up front, and the book came out, and now it's on sale at various places, the mm-hmm. IU Northwest Bookstore, Lake Street Gallery in Miller, and at City Hall are the main three places where people can get it. And in fact, we had the Gary Public Library had a celebration and book signing last Friday, and we were able to thank our sponsors. And I was telling somebody from the Legacy Foundation that some of the photos in here, such as the DK Devils refurbishing Union Station and the Calumet Artist Residency projects that involve a lot of young kids, a lot of projects that the Legacy Foundation itself has sponsored found photos of those activities in our book.
When you got the things together to be able to put the first edition out, were most of these items, the photos, of course, in particular, and then, of course, descriptions that you had to link in captions to the photos, had they come from the Calumet Region Archives, the one that you helped curate at IU Northwest?
Yes, most of them did, and some of them came from the archives of the Post-Tribune. But as you mentioned, I'm co-director, along with Ron Cohen, of the Calumet Regional Archives at IU Northwest, which the two of us founded. And we have over 500 collections, so a lot of the photos are in there. We also wanted to we consulted some of the nationality clubs and people we knew that were connected with, say, Romanian or Slovak or other ethnic groups, in order to have that full diversity in there. And this past edition, we leaned very heavily on professional photographs that, say, Times reporters for the newspaper took, and other Guy Rhodes is a professional photographer and an East Chicago Central grad.
Yeah, in fact, we've had him on the program talking about his photos and the work he does.
Oh, he did this great photo of the air show where he's in one of these planes, you know, flying above the crowd at Marquette Park. It was, in fact, you know, the first edition, it was pretty easy to find historical photographs of the early days in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And it became harder as we took it up to the present. And so the newspaper photographers have really been a help throughout all three editions.
I can imagine. In the first part of the book, you get a lot of great photos, historic photos, particularly of neighborhoods in Gary and particularly of downtown Gary.
Yeah.
People today, in looking at the book, would probably shake their head. They would not believe how downtown Gary looked. But it's not being exaggerating. It was a very, very vibrant downtown, probably as vibrant or maybe in some cases more so than some other communities, not only in our region, but probably the rest of the Midwest.
Yeah, in the 1920s, which I call Gary's Augustan Age, many of the buildings that still remain, the KFC building, the bank building, the city hall, were built in the 1920s. And so that was sort of one heyday prior to the coming of the Great Depression. And then the World War II period was, you might say, a second heyday, with war industries employing so many people that you had an in-migration of Southern whites and African Americans, and a housing shortage where people lived as, you know, as far away as Cedar Lake, where a bus three times a day would bring them to work. In the 1920s, there was a streetcar system that linked the whole region, and people, you know, it was a commercial hub for the region, and people could get on a streetcar and shop in Gary and go to the Palace Theater or one of the other dozen theaters in Gary and spend the day shopping at the various department stores, Goldblatt's and others that people still remember, the aroma of roasted nuts as they would walk in the back of Goldblatt's.
Mm-hmm. The book features lots and lots of photos, and besides the ones that you might expect in a book like this, with a lot of photos of steel making activities and the like, and of people who work at the steel mills. But you mentioned, and you said you went to the many groups that had various activities, whether it was a fraternal or whether it was a social activity of some sort, and lots of pictures of people. As you mentioned, that's an interesting part of the book, I think, is the fact that it is very people-oriented. A lot of architecture, as we say, all these great photos of downtown Gary and its heydays, both of them, as you mentioned, but also, too, a lot of people that are participating in activities, even going back into the 20s and the 30s. And you say during wartime, when people were busy working for the the war effort, but they still had time to have fun and they had time to get together and socialize if need be.
And like the Palace Theater seated almost 3,000 people, and they would, and you still talk to people in their 60s and 70s that remember going to the movies Saturday morning, and then going off to get something to eat, and like I say, spending the day in Gary, and we were cognizant of wanting to do that. And in addition to the other sources I mentioned, Facebook and other various social media are good sources of photographs as well. You have to make sure you get permission, but there were two photos that I think are among my favorites. We have a page devoted to religious services. Mm-hmm. And so one of the photos taken by a professional photographer is the Wirt Emerson Choir singing at Holy Angels for Easter services, I think it was. And of course, Wirt Emerson is no longer in existence. And Holy Angels is still there, but doesn't have the attendance it once was. But then we have another photograph, again a very professional one of Saint Timothy, and a Vesper service that Billy Foster, the great jazz pianist, who's a member of that church, composed. And we didn't think we might. I wanted a third photo that made it in. Fortunately, I was never quite sure whether the person putting the book together would follow my instructions. But we have a third picture of Trinity Baptist Church and the Reverend Dwight Gardner, and that church is also 100 years old. And Dwight Gardner is as an example of somebody that was a head of physical plant at IU Northwest who had a calling and went out and is a pastor now. And you find, Gary is honeycombed with these churches that become community centers and hold neighborhoods together. There's a church, a Progressive Community Church, right down where Emerson School used to be, where they're starting urban gardens. And so a lot of things are emanating from those churches. I know, and not just the big traditional ones.
I know we don't have a lot of time left in the conversation for today, but we'd be remiss if we didn't mention about the big physical and psychological and political changes that happened in the city of Gary over the years, particularly in the 50s into the 60s, and even as late as the 1970s. And the book does a very good job, I think, of outlining a lot of these events by pictures, showing political candidates and particularly historical political candidates in their visits to Gary and people coming by and trying to campaign to get the civil rights movement going.
Yeah, one of the final photos in the book shows the present mayor, Karen Freeman Wilson, with former mayor Richard Hatcher in his 80s. It was taken in 2016 as they were promoting an upcoming national political convention or an event honoring the famous one that took place at Westside in 1972. And both of those people, Mayor Hatcher and Freeman Wilson, they could have gone anywhere and made a ton of money. Hatcher was an internationally known person, head of Trans Africa, et cetera, et cetera. But they've chose, like a lot of other people, to remain in Gary and try to keep their city vibrant. And Hatcher, I mentioned this in a recent Steel Shavings magazine that I put out. At a time during the 1960s when many civil rights contemporaries of his were losing faith in the political system as riots went on and assassinations of our leaders like Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, he kept faith in playing within the system. and really dedicated his life, I think, to trying to promote other young black people into going into public service, including his daughter, of course.
Well, Professor Lane, we're out of time for this conversation, but we'll have to get you back in here again. We could probably just go through the entire book and break it down by segment and talk about it too. But once again, the third edition of the book, which is entitled Gary, A Pictorial History, that is published. The authors are one of our guests here today, Professor Emeritus James Lane and Ronald Cohen. They have put together an updated book right up to this year, as a matter of fact, here. And you can find out more by going online, find out about the book, where it's available, and all some of the places here in Northwest Indiana that you can pick up copies of the book. And we certainly thank you for spending time with us to talk about this. And we will have another conversation again to break out some of these other specific dates and eras of the city of Gary, how it's grown and how it's changed and managed to stay alive, despite what many people have thought would not happen. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte.
IU Northwest Professor Jack Bloom is with us to talk about his book, Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement. Professor Bloom, thank you for being with us today on the program.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Okay, let's ask the obvious question. Will you please take a minute and tell us a little bit about the book that going into the second edition? So there are obviously some people that are very interested in the book, and you wanted to make some changes in the book. But tell us first, what got you into the idea to put the book together and to have the first edition published?
Well, I came of age in the civil rights movement, and it deeply affected my life and my way of thinking. So when I sat down to write what was my first book, I wanted to ask myself the question, how and why did this happen? And so I started digging. And what it became to me, what happened was that blacks were able to make changes in the 50s and 60s when they'd never before been able to do so. Why? What changed to make that possible? That was the question that I posed to myself. And as I started digging in, I realized that in order to understand that, I had to understand what was it that they were confronting and where did that come from. And that took me all the way back to Reconstruction, actually. And what I found was that in the rest of the 19th century was a war, essentially, that went on in the South over who was going to run things, who was going to be on top. Because when the Civil War ended slavery, but that left open the whole question of who was going to work for whom and under what conditions. And so that's what I dug into. And what I found was that this long battle that took place ended up with the former slave owners on top. They created the system. And it was a system in which they had a political party, the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party used to be the party of white supremacy and of states' rights. Mm-hmm. And they had a means of warfare, that is guerrilla warfare, that is the Ku Klux Klan, which they used to suppress any opposition. What they did finally was they took the vote away from blacks, but the amendments to the Constitution that were put through during Reconstruction gave the vote to blacks, and so they couldn't take away the vote on the basis of race. But the Constitution says nothing about class. And so they enacted a number of class remedies to keep blacks from voting, which also kept large numbers of whites from voting as well. In some states, as many as 60% of the white population lost the right to vote when blacks lost the right to vote. And so that was the situation that they were facing as they came into the 50s and 60s. What changed to make it possible for them to challenge it? What I found was that the Great Depression and World War II fundamentally changed the economy of the South so that business rather than agriculture became the main source of income, and an elite based on that business also grew up. Now, that elite was just as racist as the old elite was, but they had a vulnerability which the old elite didn't have. The old elite was perfectly able and did many times use violence to prevent any challenge to their rule. The new elite, business people, couldn't do that because if they had used violence, what would happen was business people don't like to go to places where there's turmoil. That's not where they want to invest. And for example, in 1957, Little Rock, Arkansas was under court order to desegregate its school.
Right.
And nine black students were supposed to go into the high school. They were kept out. They were kept out by both mobs and by the National Guard, brought in by the governor of Arkansas. Well, eventually what happened was the president sent in, nationalized the National Guard, and then sent in paratroopers who he kept in the school for a whole year. What were the consequences of this? For years after the after World War II, Little Rock had been the recipient of millions of dollars of investment. For 5 years, starting in 1957, they didn't get a penny because of this turmoil that they created. The result of that was, and also they ended up closing the schools in Little Rock and also in a couple of schools in Virginia. And what that did was that attacked not only the business people, but the middle class. Because what middle class people have to give to their children is not a fortune, but an education. And they closed the schools down. This brought the middle class out, and both in Little Rock and in Virginia, they overturned the school boards, recalled them, put in new school boards, and essentially went along with the program which the Supreme Court had outlined in its 1954 Brown versus Board of Education ruling. So that was what made it possible. It didn't make anything inevitable. If something was going to happen, blacks were going to have to organize and create it. And that's what happened. And so all that turmoil of the civil rights movement, which became best known in Birmingham and in Selma, Birmingham in 63 and Selma in 65, and the result of the Birmingham demonstrations was the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and the result of the Selma demonstrations was the 1965 Voting Rights Act. So that's what changed to make it possible. And then blacks had to change themselves and organize themselves, and they succeeded in doing so.
I know that the book's been out there and been in use, I guess, for more than 30 years. You mentioned, and other people have mentioned apparently too, about the fact that, I guess the subject of class hadn't been brought up, and other publications are out there, other text or academic books of the sort. Is that your thinking, why the book has been used for so long in the first edition, and you've expounded on that here in this latest edition?
That's one of the main reasons. Yeah. The other main reason for it was that I looked at how blacks themselves changed. It was not an easy process. They had been kept subjected. Many of them bought that they were inferior. This was something that both Martin Luther King and Malcolm X railed about. Malcolm X, you know, talked all the time about how people were, for example, putting on skin lighteners and straightening their hair to look like whites. King, you know, did the same sort of thing. And so they had to overcome that. And in the process, in the 40s, the 50s, and the 60s, they succeeded in doing that.
In this second edition that has come out that you're going to talk about in more detail in the talk later this month, you said you wanted to kind of add to some updates in a way. But in particular, there's one point that you mentioned that you wanted to add a chapter that would talk about the long-term consequences of the movement. Is that something that this, over time that maybe you brought up in classes where you've taught the subject and then you thought that maybe it was time to put it in the book?
Yes, you know, I've become increasingly aware of what happened. The movement to try to stop desegregation in the South in the 50s and 60s was called the Massive Resistance Movement. And one of the things that this book does is it shows how and why that movement failed. What I didn't really fully understand at the time was that that was not the only form of resistance to desegregation. That, in fact, there were other less obnoxious ways of trying to turn things around. And that is what has proceeded. That is, what the most significant thing I think that has happened since the Civil Rights Movement has been the rise of the right. It's, you know, starting with the election of President Nixon, and then with who talked about the Southern Strategy, although it even began before then. Barry Goldwater, for example, ran in 1964 while Republican senators and congresspeople voted for the Civil Rights Act and for the Voting Rights Act in a higher proportion than Democrats did, because Southern Democrats were against it.
Right.
Barry Goldwater was one of the few non-Southern senators who opposed the Civil Rights Act. And that kind of began to redefine the Republican Party, which previously had been, in many ways, a liberal party. It had grown out of Lincoln, right? And Lincoln had been for changing the way that blacks were treated, not just ending slavery, but giving them citizenship rights as well. And so now the Republican Party was beginning to change, and it continued to do so under Nixon. It continued to do so under Reagan and under the Bushes, so that by the end of the last century, the Republican Party had become a party where people who were white supremacists could still feel comfortable.
Bringing up to the 21st century now, do you think, in what you put in the book in both editions, the first original edition and now the second edition, as it's come out with the editions that you put in, do you still find it, or is it even now more relevant these days because of all that has happened following through and all the changes that are being at least pushed anyway to the civil rights movement?
Well, there's been a long-term effort to push back the gains of the civil rights movement. And they've had some very significant successes, the biggest of which has been that they've kind of gutted the Voting Rights Act, so that today it doesn't carry the kind of strength, really, that it once had in terms of protecting the right to vote. So, absolutely, I mean, the rise of the right has been partly, significantly, about rolling back the gains of the civil rights movement. The rise of the right has come about partly, as I say, in response to the civil rights movement, but not entirely so.
Right.
That is, what we saw in this country in sort of the center of the 20th century was something kind of unusual. This country, for example, went through a very lengthy period of conservatism following the Civil War and Reconstruction. It was turned over as a result of the Great Depression and the election of Roosevelt, the institution of of the New Deal, the creation of the unions, the growth of the middle class as a result of that, and all that now is being rolled back, both the economic gains of the New Deal and later of the Great Society, and the gains of the civil rights movement. All of them are being pushed back nowadays.
Professor Blum, are you finding surprising, or you've kind of expected that the book has picked up the popularity in a way that it has? It's an academic book, so you wouldn't necessarily think it's like a bestseller, but I know it's been kind of likened to it being a bestseller.
Well, it's an academic bestseller,
okay.
Meaning that it sold about 11,000 copies, and many more than that have read it. I was surprised. I didn't realize that. When I was concerned about the question of class and race, it hadn't really fully dawned on me that very few others had been. And so this entered an issue which hadn't really been talked about either in academia or in popular areas.
IU Northwest Professor Jack Blum's book is entitled Class, Race, and the Civil Rights Movement. It's now going into the second edition. Thank you for spending time with us to talk about the book.
Thank you for having me here.
Word from the State House yesterday and from the governor's workforce recovery task force, has come out to give us an update on one of Governor Holcomb's programs that is to help small business in Indiana, and all business for that matter, deal with the coronavirus pandemic. And as a result of the changes and expansion, there's some happy news to folks in Northwest Indiana in particular. Barbara Quant is the Indiana Director of the National Federation of Independent Business of Indiana, which is based in Indianapolis, and she's joining us to give us an update on how everyone in Indianapolis and around the state feels about the changes. Barbara, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Chris. Good to hear from you again, and to share some good news this time.
I know that the word came out yesterday from the governor's workforce cabinet about the expansion of the Next Level Jobs program. It's picked up some of the federal funds available from the CARES Act. From the changes that have been announced, will that make in helping small business to help recover from the pandemic?
Well, right now, if they're still in business, which of course we hope they are in many cases having difficulty finding qualified employees. And that's kind of two pronged, because not only are They had a problem getting qualified employees before the pandemic, but now they have folks that don't want to come back to work because they're making too much on unemployment, mm-hmm. which is an unintended consequence, I guess, of the PPP program. And right now, what the governor's doing, though, is he's now the Workforce Ready program is providing full tuition reimbursement for short-term Workforce Ready grant eligible programs through December 30th. So that's tremendous. It's not just there are grants, and then there are fully paid, which is really pretty awesome. They have 50 new certificates. So the Workforce Ready grant is to help train workers for a new career. Let's say your restaurant went out of business because of the coronavirus. You can be eligible for a grant to go ahead and be trained for a new career. And so they've expanded the numbers, the different options that you have and the different certificates that you can be eligible for.
Will you give us an idea of what the funding from the CARES Act is going to help go toward as far as the Workforce Ready grant program is concerned, and who can benefit or who is going to benefit, actually, because I know some people have already signed up to be able to get expansion on their education with Ivy mm-hmm. Tech Community College. What in turn can they take advantage of, and what the funds will be able to actually to go toward benefit, which in turn will come back to help small businesses?
Yes, there are actually two parts to this. There's grants for workers, for employees, and then there's the employer training grant, which is for employers to help train their existing workforce. So it has many different ramifications here, but it's an exciting expansion. It's been in effect for a couple years now, but now this is even more robust. And so I would certainly encourage workers as well as small businesses to check into what programs are available to them, and these are grants, not loans.
I know there are a number of positions that people can apply for if they get the grant, and they're eligible programs, wherever they may happen to be doing their training, the certificate programs. Can you tell us about some of these programs and the types of jobs that in turn will benefit small businesses? I know a lot of these particular educational opportunities will go not only for individuals, but also that will help, various companies out there.
Well, there are nursing assistants and various ones available in the medical field, but there's also the commercial driver's license, the CDL. We need truckers, truck drivers. We absolutely do mm-hmm. to help get this economy moving again.
I know
that's just one.
There are quite a few. I guess there's a limited number, I suppose, but that really is probably limited only to the programs that the Ivy Tech Community College can offer, right?
Yes. Well, what they've done is they have based these, from what I understand, they have looked at where employers need workers and the most in-demand jobs, and have tailored these new certificates and these grants to those particular jobs.
I know that the next level jobs information is also available online. So if there are people that have questions, if they're interested in actually being able to enroll in the programs, how can they do so?
They can visit nextleveljobs.org online. And there's also the Rapid Recovery Hub, which is yourstepin.org as well. So be sure and check that out. And if you have any additional questions, please feel free to contact NFIB. Go to our website, and we will have it on our website as well.
We're talking with Barbara.
NFIB.com.
I'm sorry. We're talking with Barbara Quant, who is the Indiana State Director of the NFIB. And we know that you get information in from the researchers and from the pollsters all the time on a regular basis. What's the latest information that you found within Indiana as to how businesses are doing and as they try to recover from the pandemic?
Well, sometimes, Chris, it feels like one step forward, two steps back. Mm-hmm. But because businesses are still struggling, and some areas are more open for the economy than others. And, well, in Indianapolis, for instance, it's behind the state. We're in the fourth level, I guess, in Indianapolis. But as we move on, that creates problems, and some businesses have opened up only to close again because it wasn't working for them. So it is a difficult environment out there, and there are some real signs of life, which are I'm glad to hear that. And of course there is the PPP, which everyone's probably heard about a lot, is still available. If you haven't applied for it before, so it's there is still PPP money, but we're actually going to need something after that, Chris. It's now that this money is running out, there's going to need to be something else to help small businesses get a leg up towards recovery. And what the state is doing is helpful in that they have grants for those that haven't received PPP loans. And so there are so many options available that are there to help. But I hate to say it, we're going to need more.
Mm-hmm. How often are you getting the updates now, since things have not quite settled down, but there's some progress? Like you said, it keeps opening and closing.
Yes. And what we're finding is that people are now the problem is applying for forgiveness. If you know the PPP, and practically 90% of small businesses have applied for some kind of relief. And now that they got the money, it isn't just automatic. It's not a grant. It doesn't become a grant until you apply for forgiveness. And mm-hmm. so you have to meet certain criteria in order. Mostly it was for payroll, but there were other operating expenses that were covered too. So you have to work with your banker to make sure that you are applying correctly. Now we have one going on right now, as a matter of fact, we have a number of webinars on just this. How do you do this? People have so many questions about the process, who's eligible, what do you need to do, what do you not need to do. And so I would suggest they go to our website at nfib.com/coronavirus, and if you'll see webinars on every imaginable subject relating to the COVID-19 crisis.
When you mentioned what's available on the NFIB Indiana website, does that give a place too that, although you have probably other ways to get the information, but you get feedback from not only the small businesses that may decide to apply or put maybe some of their employees up for the training programs, the webinars in particular, since that's what's available out there now, but any other programs that may be coming up that they can sign up in the future, they get all the information that way too?
Yes, absolutely. There are many different subjects that we've gone into, particularly with our research foundation, because we've been conducting research for many decades. And of course, I've been talking to you almost every week about what's going on, and that all is driven from the research that we do with all small businesses across the country and in Indiana.
Well, Barbara, thank you for the input today and getting us up to date, and the fact that we know that the NFIB Indiana is very pleased with what the Workforce Cabinet has been doing as far as the Next Level Jobs program is concerned with the expansion of that. We'll have you back on again to talk more as the information comes in. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Barbara Quant is the Indiana State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. And thank you for joining us today. Tomorrow on Regionally Speaking, we bring you up to date on some of the stories that our reporters in the region have put out there in print and online. We'll have conversations from that and bring you up to date on an interesting letter that an important community leader has put into the newspaper. Well, that and more coming up tomorrow. Hope you'll be able to join us.